half's edges. The small hint became immense, as if the darkness held nothing but a flood of leaves. The mechanical ball of glass made the leaves seem more living. It took away their color and gave the promise that in daylight they would be a brighter green than had ever existed. It took away one's sight and left a new sense instead, neither smell nor touch, yet both, a sense of spring and space. Keating stopped when he recognized the preposterous orange hair in the darkness of the porch. It was the one person whom he had wanted to see tonight. He was glad to find Rourke alone, and a little afraid of it.
"Congratulations, Peter," said Rourke.
Oh, thanks. Keating was surprised to find that he felt more pleasure than from any other compliment he had received today. He was timidly glad that Rourke approved, and he called himself inwardly a fool for it.
"I mean, do you know? Or,"
he added sharply, "has Mother been telling you?"
"She has."
"She shouldn't have."
"Why not?"
"Look, Howard, you know that I'm terribly sorry about your being." Rourke threw his head back and looked up at him.
"Forget it," said Rourke.
There's something I want to speak to you about, Howard, to ask your advice. Mind if I sit down?"
"What is it?"
Keating sat down on the steps beside him. There was no part that he could ever play in Rourke's presence. Besides, he did not feel like playing a part now. He heard a leaf rustling in its fall to the earth. It was a thin, glassy, spring sound. He knew for the moment that he felt affection for Rourke, an affection that held pain, astonishment, and helplessness.
"You won't think," said Keating gently, in complete sincerity, "that it's awful of me to be asking about my business when you've just been..."
"I said forget about that."
"What is it?" "You know," said Keating, honestly and unexpectedly, even to himself, "I've often thought that you're crazy. But I know that you know many things about it, architecture, I mean, which those fools never knew. And I know that you love it as they never will."
"Well?"
"Well, I don't know why I should come to you, but... Howard, I've never said it before, but you see, I'd rather have your opinion on things than the dean's. I'd probably follow the dean's, but it's just that yours means more to me myself. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm saying this either."
Rourke turned over on his side, looked at him, and laughed.
It was a young, kind, friendly laughter, a thing so rare to hear from Rourke that Keating felt as if someone had taken his hand in reassurance. And he forgot that he had a party in Boston waiting for him.
"Come on," said Rourke. "You're not being afraid of me, are you? What do you want to ask about?"
"It's about my scholarship. The Paris prize I got."
"Yes."
"It's for 4 years. But on the other hand, Guy Francon offered me a job with him some time ago. Today he said it's still open. And I don't know which to take."
Rourke looked at him.
Rourke's fingers moved in slow rotation, beating against the steps.
"If you want my advice, Peter," he said at last, "you've made a mistake already. By asking me, by asking anyone. Never ask people, not about your work.
Don't you know what you want? How can you stand it, not to know?" "You see, that's what I admire about you, Howard. You always know."
"Drop the compliments."
"But I mean it. How do you always manage to decide?"
"How can you let others decide for you?"
"But you see, I'm not sure, Howard. I'm never sure of myself. I don't know whether I'm as good as they all tell me I am. I wouldn't admit that to anyone but you. I think it's because you're always so sure that I..."
"Petey!"
Mrs. Keating's voice exploded behind them.
"Petey, sweetheart, what are you doing there?"
She stood in the doorway, in her best dress of burgundy taffeta, happy and angry.
"And here I've been sitting all alone waiting for you. What on earth are you doing on those filthy steps in your dress suit? Get up this minute. Come on in the house, boys. I've got hot chocolate and cookies ready for you." "But, Mother, I wanted to speak to Howard about something important," said Keating.
But he rose to his feet. She seemed not to have heard. She walked into the house. Keating followed. Rourke looked after them, shrugged, rose, and went in also. Mrs. Keating settled down in an armchair, her stiff skirt crackling.
Well, she asked, what were you two discussing out there?
Keating fingered an ashtray, picked up a matchbox and dropped it, then, ignoring her, turned to Rourke.
Look, Howard, drop the pose, he said, his voice high. Shall I junk the scholarship and go to work, or let Francone wait and grab the Beaux-Arts to impress the yokels? What do you think?
Something was gone. The one moment was lost.
Now, Petey, let me get this straight,
began Mrs. Keating.
Oh, wait a minute, Mother. Howard, I've got to weigh it carefully. It isn't everyone who can get a scholarship like that. You're pretty good when you rate that. A course at the Beaux-Arts. You know how important that is.
I don't, said Rourke.
Oh, hell, I know your crazy ideas, but I'm speaking practically. For a man in my position, ideals aside for a moment, it certainly is...
You don't want my advice, said Rourke.
Of course I do. I'm asking you.
But Keating could never be the same when he had an audience. Any audience. Something was gone. He did not know it, but he felt that Rourke knew. Rourke's eyes made him uncomfortable, and that made him angry.
I want to practice architecture, snapped Keating, not talk about it. Gives you a great prestige, the old école. Puts you above the rank and file of the ex-plumbers who think they can build. On the other hand, an opening with Francone, Guy Francone himself offering it.
Rourke turned away.
How many boys will match that? Keating went on blindly. A year from now they'll be boasting they're working for Smith or Jones, if they find work at all, while I'll be with Francone and higher.
You're quite right, Peter, said Mrs. Keating, rising. On a question like that you don't want to consult your mother. It's too important. I'll leave you to settle it with Mr. Rourke.
He looked at his mother. He did not want to hear what she thought of this. He knew that his only chance to decide was to make the decision before he heard her. She had stopped, looking at him, ready to turn and leave the room. He knew it was not a pose. She would leave if he wished it. He wanted her to go. He wanted it desperately. He said,
"Why, Mother, how can you say that? Of course I want your opinion. What do you think?"
She ignored the raw irritation in his voice. She smiled.
"Petey, I never think anything. It's up to you. It's always been up to you."
"Well," he began hesitantly, watching her, "if I go to the Beaux-Arts..."
"Fine," said Mrs. Keating. "Go to the Beaux-Arts. It's a grand place, a whole ocean away from your home. Of course, if you go, Mr. Francone will take somebody else. People will talk about that. Everybody knows that Mr. Francone picks out the best boy from Stanton every year for his office. I wonder how it'll look if some other boy gets the job. But I guess that doesn't matter."
What will people say?"
"Nothing much, I guess. Only that the other boy was the best man of his class. I guess he'll take Schlinker."
"No," he gulped furiously.
"Not Schlinker."
"Yes,"
she said sweetly.
"Schlinker. But why should you care what people say? All you have to do is please yourself."
"And you think that Francone..."
"Why should I think of Mr. Francone? It's nothing to me."
"Mother, you want me to take the job with Francone?"
"I don't want anything, Petey. You're the boss."
He wondered whether he really liked his mother. But she was his mother, and this fact was recognized by everybody as meaning automatically that he loved her, and so he took for granted that whatever he felt for her was love. He did not know whether there was any reason why he should respect her judgment. She was his mother. That was supposed to take the place of reasons. "Yes, of course, Mother. But..."
"Yes, I know, but..."
"Howard?" It was a plea for help. Rourke was there, on a davenport in the corner, half lying, sprawled limply like a kitten. It had often astonished Keating. He had seen Rourke moving with the soundless tension, the control, the precision of a cat. He had seen him relaxed, like a cat, in shapeless ease, as if his body held no single solid bone. Rourke glanced up at him. He said,
"Peter, you know how I feel about either one of your opportunities. Take your choice of the lesser evil. What will you learn at the Beaux-Arts? Only more Renaissance palaces and operetta settings. They'll kill everything you might have in you. You do good work once in a while when somebody lets you. If you really want to learn, go to work. Francon is a bastard and a fool, but you will be building. It will prepare you for going on your own that much sooner.
Even Mr. Rourke can talk sense sometimes, said Mrs. Keating, even if he does talk like a truck driver.
Do you really think that I do good work? Keating looked at him, as if his eyes still held the reflection of that one sentence, and nothing else mattered. Occasionally, said Rourke. Not often.
Now that it's all settled, began Mrs. Keating,
I'll have to think it over, Mother.
Now that it's all settled, how about the hot chocolate? I'll have it out to you in a jiffy.
She smiled at her son, an innocent smile that declared her obedience and gratitude, and she rustled out of the room. Keating paced nervously, stopped, lighted a cigarette, stood spitting the smoke out in short jerks, then looked at Rourke. What are you going to do now, Howard?
I?
Very thoughtless of me, I know, going on like that about myself. Mother means well, but she drives me crazy. Well, to hell with that. What are you going to do?
I'm going to New York.
Oh, swell. To get a job?
To get a job.
In architecture?
In architecture, Peter.
That's grand. I'm glad. Got any definite prospects?
I'm going to work for Henry Cameron.
Oh, no, Howard.
Rourke smiled slowly, the corners of his mouth sharp, and said nothing.
Oh, no, Howard.
Yes.
But he's nothing, nobody anymore. Oh, I know he has a name, but he's done for. He never gets any important buildings, hasn't had any for years. They say he's got a dump for an office. What kind of future will you get out of him? What will you learn?
Not much. Only how to build.
For God's sake, you can't go on like that, deliberately ruining yourself. I thought you'd learned something today.
I have.
Look, Howard, if it's because you think that no one else will have you now, no one better, why, I'll help you. I'll work old Francon, and I'll get connections, and...
Thank you, Peter. But it won't be necessary. It's settled.
What did he say?
Who?
Cameron.
I've never met him.
Then a horn screamed outside. Keating remembered. Started off to change his clothes, collided with his mother at the door, and knocked a cup off her loaded tray.
Petey!
Never mind, Mother. He seized her elbows. I'm in a hurry, sweetheart. A little party with the boys.
Now, don't say anything. I won't be late, and...
Look, we'll celebrate my going with Francon and Heyer. He kissed her impulsively, with the gay exuberance that made him irresistible at times, and flew out of the room up the stairs. Mrs. Keating shook her head, flustered, reproving and happy. In his room, while flinging his clothes in all directions, Keating thought suddenly of a wire he would send to New York. That particular subject had not been in his mind all day, but it came to him with a sense of desperate urgency. He wanted to send that wire now, at once. He scribbled it down on a piece of paper. Katie, dearest, coming New York, job Francon. Love, ever, Peter. That night Keating raced toward Boston, wedged in between two boys, the wind and the road whistling past him. And he thought that the world was open to him now, like the darkness fleeing before the bobbing headlights. He was free. He was ready. In a few years, so very soon, for time did not exist in the speed of that car, his name would ring like a horn, ripping people out of sleep. He was ready to do great things, magnificent things, things unsurpassed in
architecture.
Chapter 3 Peter Keating looked at the streets of New York. The people, he observed, were extremely well-dressed. He had stopped for a moment before the building on Fifth Avenue, where the office of Francon and Heyer and his first day of work awaited him. He looked at the men who hurried past. Smart, he thought, smart as hell. He glanced regretfully at his own clothes. He had a great deal to learn in New York. When he could delay it no longer, he turned to the door. It was a miniature Doric portico, every inch of it scaled down to the exact proportions decreed by the artists who had worn flowing Grecian tunics. Between the marble perfection of the columns, a revolving door sparkled with nickel plate, reflecting the streaks of automobiles flying past. Keating walked through the revolving door, through the lustrous marble lobby, to an elevator of gilt and red lacquer that brought him, 30 floors later, to a mahogany door. He saw a slender brass plate with delicate letters. Francone and Hire, Architects. The reception room of the office of Francone and Hire, Architects, looked like a cool, intimate ballroom in a colonial mansion. The silver-white walls were paneled with flat pilasters. The pilasters were fluted and curved into Ionic snails. They supported little pediments broken in the middle to make room for half a Grecian urn plastered against the wall. Etchings of Greek temples adorned the panels, too small to be distinguished, but presenting the unmistakable columns, pediments, and crumbling stone. Quite incongruously, Keating felt as if a conveyor belt was under his feet from the moment he crossed the threshold. It carried him to the reception clerk, who sat at a telephone switchboard behind the white balustrade of a Florentine balcony. It transferred him to the threshold of a huge drafting room. He saw long, flat tables, a forest of twisted rods descending from the ceiling to end in green-shaded lamps, enormous blueprint files, towers of yellow drawers, papers, tin boxes, sample bricks, pots of glue, and calendars from construction companies, most of them bearing pictures of naked women. The chief draftsman snapped at Keating without quite seeing him. He was bored and crackling with purpose simultaneously. He jerked his thumb in the direction of a locker room, thrust his chin out toward the door of a locker, and stood, rocking from heels to toes, while Keating pulled a pearl-gray smock over his stiff, uncertain body. Francone had insisted on that smock. The conveyor belt stopped at a table in a corner of the drafting room, where Keating found himself with a set of plans to expand, the scraggy back of the chief draftsman retreating from him in the unmistakable manner of having forgotten his existence. Keating bent over his task at once, his eyes fixed, his throat rigid. He saw nothing but the pearly shimmer of the paper before him. The steady lines he drew surprised him, for he felt certain that his hand was jerking an inch back and forth across the sheet. He followed the lines, not knowing where they led or why. He knew only that the plan was someone's tremendous achievement, which he could neither question nor equal. He wondered why he had ever thought of himself as a potential architect. Much later, he noticed the wrinkles of a gray smock sticking to a pair of shoulder blades over the next table. He glanced about him, cautiously at first, then with curiosity, then with pleasure, then with contempt. When he reached this last, Peter Keating became himself again and felt love for mankind. He noticed sallow cheeks, a funny nose, a wart on a receding chin, a stomach squashed against the edge of a table. He loved these sights. What these could do, he could do better. He smiled. Peter Keating needed his fellow men. When he glanced at his plans again, he noticed the flaws glaring at him from the masterpiece. It was the floor of a private residence, and he noted the twisted hallways that sliced great hunks of space for no apparent reason, the long rectangular sausages of rooms doomed to darkness. Jesus, he thought, they'd have flunked me for this in the first term. After which, he proceeded with his work swiftly, easily, expertly, and happily. Before lunchtime, Keating had made friends in the room, not any definite friends, but a vague soil spread and ready from which friendships would spring. He had smiled at his neighbors and winked an understanding over nothing at all. He had used each trip to the water cooler to caress those he passed with the soft, cheering glow of his eyes, the brilliant eyes that seemed to pick each man in turn out of the room, out of the universe, as the most important specimen of humanity and as Keating's dearest friend. There goes, there seemed to be left in his wake, a smart boy and a hell of a good fellow. Keating noticed that a tall blonde youth at the next table was doing the elevation of an office building. Keating leaned with chummy respect against the boy's shoulder and looked at the laurel garlands entwined about fluted columns 3 floors high. "Pretty good for the old man," said Keating with admiration. "Who?" asked the boy. "Why, Francone," said Keating. "Francone, hell," said the boy placidly. "He hasn't designed a doghouse in 8 years." He jerked his thumb over his shoulder, at a glass door behind them.
Him.
What? Asked Keating, turning.
Him, said the boy. Stengel. He does all these things.
Behind the glass door, Keating saw a pair of bony shoulders above the edge of a desk, a small triangular head bent intently, and two blank pools of light in the round frames of glasses. It was late in the afternoon when a presence seemed to have passed beyond the closed door, and Keating learned from the rustle of whispers around him that Guy Francone had arrived and had risen to his office on the floor above. Half an hour later, the glass door opened, and Stengel came out, a huge piece of cardboard dangling between his fingers.
"Hey, you," he said, his glasses stopping on Keating's face. "You doing the plans for this?"
He swung the cardboard forward.
"Take this up to the boss for the okay. Try to listen to what he'll say and try to look intelligent, neither of which matters anyway."
He was short, and his arms seemed to hang down to his ankles, arms swinging like ropes in the long sleeves, with big, efficient hands. Keating's eyes froze, darkening for 1/10 of a second, gathered in a tight stare at the blank lenses. Then Keating smiled and said pleasantly,
"Yes, sir."
He carried the cardboard on the tips of his 10 fingers up the crimson plushed stairway to Guy Francone's office. The cardboard displayed a watercolor perspective of a gray granite mansion with 3 tiers of dormers, 5 balconies, 4 bays, 12 columns, 1 flagpole, and 2 lions at the entrance. In the corner, neatly printed by hand, stood, "Residence of Mr. and Mrs. James S. Wattles, Francone and Hire Architects." Keating whistled softly. James S. Wattles was the multimillionaire manufacturer of shaving lotions. Guy Francone's office was polished. No, thought Keating, not polished, but shellacked. No, not shellacked, but liquid, with mirrors melted and poured over every object. He saw splinters of his own reflection let loose like a swarm of butterflies following him across the room, on the Chippendale cabinets, on the Jacobean chairs, on the Louis XV mantelpiece. He had time to note a genuine Roman statue in a corner, sepia photographs of the Parthenon, of Reims Cathedral, of Versailles, and of the French National Bank building with the eternal torch. He saw his own legs approaching him in the side of the massive mahogany desk. Guy Francone sat behind the desk. Guy Francone's face was yellow, and his cheeks sagged. He looked at Keating for an instant as if he had never seen him before, then remembered and smiled expansively.
"Well, well, well, Kittredge, my boy, here we are, all set and at home. So glad to see you. Sit down, boys, sit down. What have you got there? Well, there's no hurry, no hurry at all. Sit down. How do you like it here?"
"I'm afraid, sir, that I'm a little too happy," said Keating, with an expression of frank, boyish helplessness. "I thought I could be businesslike on my first job, but starting in a place like this, I guess it knocked me out a little. I'll get over it, sir," he promised.
"Of course," said Guy Francone. "It might be a bit overwhelming for a boy, just a bit. But don't you worry. I'm sure you'll make good."
"I'll do my best, sir."
"Of course you will. What's this they sent me?"
Francone extended his hand to the drawing, but his fingers came to rest limply on his forehead instead.
"It's so annoying, this headache."
"No, no, nothing serious."
He smiled at Keating's prompt concern.
"Just a little mal de tête. One works so hard."
"Is there anything I can get for you, sir?"
"No, no, thank you. It's not anything you can get for me. It's if only you could take something away from me." He winked. "The champagne. Entre nous, that champagne of theirs wasn't worth a damn last night. I've never cared for champagne anyway. Let me tell you, Kittredge, it's very important to know about wines. For instance, when you'll take a client out to dinner, and will want to be sure of the proper thing to order. Now, I'll tell you a professional secret. Take quail, for instance. Now, most people would order Burgundy with it. What do? You call for Clos Vougeot 1904. See? Adds that certain touch. Correct, but original. One must always be original. Who sent you up, by the way?"
"Mr. Stengel, sir."
"Oh, Stengel."
The tone in which he pronounced the name clicked like a shutter in Keating's mind. It was a permission to be stored away for future use.
Too grand to bring his own stuff up, eh? Mind you, he's a great designer, the best designer in New York City, but he's just getting to be a bit too grand lately. He thinks he's the only one doing any work around here just because I give him ideas and let him work them out for me, just because he smudges at a board all day long. You'll learn, my boy, when you've been in the business longer, that the real work of an office is done beyond its walls. Take last night, for instance, banquet of the Clarion Real Estate Association. 200 guests, dinner and champagne. Oh, yes. Champagne. He wrinkled his nose fastidiously in self-mockery. A few words to say informally in a little after-dinner speech. You know, nothing blatant. No vulgar sales talk. Only a few well-chosen thoughts on the responsibility of realtors to society, on the importance of selecting architects who are competent, respected, and well-established. You know, a few bright little slogans that will stick in the mind. Yes, sir. Like, choose the builder of your home as carefully as you choose the bride to inhabit it. Not bad. Not bad at all, Kittredge. Mind if I jot it down? My name is Keating, sir, said Keating firmly. You are very welcome to the idea. I'm very happy if it appeals to you. Keating, of course. Why, of course. Keating, said Francone with a disarming smile. Dear me, one meets so many people. How did you say it? Choose the builder. It was very well put. He made Keating repeat it, and wrote it down on a pad, picking a pencil from an array before him, new, many-colored pencils, sharpened to a professional needle point, ready, unused. Then he pushed the pad aside, sighed, patted the smooth waves of his hair, and said wearily, "Well, all right. I suppose I'll have to look at the thing." Keating extended the drawing respectfully. Francone leaned back, held the cardboard out at arm's length, and looked at it. He closed his left eye, then his right eye, then moved the cardboard an inch farther. Keating expected wildly to see him turn the drawing upside down. But Francone just held it. And Keating knew, suddenly, that he had long since stopped seeing it. Francone was studying it for his, Keating's, benefit. And then Keating felt light, light as air, and he saw the road to his future clear and open. Yes, Francone was saying, rubbing his chin with the tips of two soft fingers. Yes. He turned to Keating. Not bad, said Francone. Not bad at all. Well, perhaps it could have been more distinguished, you know, but... Well, the drawing is done so neatly. What do you think, Keating? Keating thought that four of the windows faced four mammoth granite columns. But he looked at Francone's fingers playing with the petunia mauve necktie and decided not to mention it. He said instead, If I may make a suggestion, sir, it seems to me that the cartouches between the fourth and fifth floors are somewhat too modest for so imposing a building. It would appear that an ornamented string course would be so much more appropriate. That's it. I was just going to say it. An ornamented string course. But look, it would mean diminishing the fenestration, wouldn't it? Yes, said Keating, a faint coating of diffidence over the tone he had used in discussions with his classmates. But windows are less important than the dignity of a building's facade. That's right. Dignity. We must give our clients dignity above all. Yes, definitely. An ornamented string course. Only... Look, I've approved the preliminary drawings, and Stengel has had this done up so neatly. Mr. Stengel will be delighted to change it if you advise him to. Francone's eyes held Keating's for a moment. Then Francone's lashes dropped, and he picked a piece of lint off his sleeve. Of course, he said vaguely. But do you think the string course is really important? I think... said Keating, slowly. It is more important to make changes you find necessary than to okay every drawing just as Mr. Stengel designed it. Because Francone said nothing, but only looked straight at him, because Francone's eyes were focused and his hands limp, Keating knew that he had taken a terrible chance and won.
He became frightened by the chance after he knew he had won. They looked silently across the desk, and both saw that they were two men who could understand each other. "We'll have an ornamented string course," said Francone, with calm, genuine authority. "Leave this here. Tell Stengel that I want to see him." He had turned to go. Francone stopped him. Francone's voice was gay and warm. "Oh, Keating, by the way, may I make a suggestion? Just between us, no offense intended. But a burgundy necktie would be so much better than blue with your gray smock. Don't you think so?"
"Yes, sir," said Keating easily. "Thank you. You'll see it tomorrow."
He walked out and closed the door softly. On his way back through the reception room, Keating saw a distinguished gray-haired gentleman escorting a lady to the door. The gentleman wore no hat and obviously belonged to the office. The lady wore a mink cape and was obviously a client. The gentleman was not bowing to the ground. He was not unrolling a carpet. He was not waving a fan over her head. He was only holding the door for her. It merely seemed to Keating that the gentleman was doing all of that. The Frank National Bank building rose over Lower Manhattan, and its long shadow moved as the sun traveled over the sky, like a huge clock hand across grimy tenements from the aquarium to Manhattan Bridge. When the sun was gone, the torch of Hadrian's mausoleum flared up in its stead and made glowing red smears on the glass of windows for miles around, on the top stories of buildings high enough to reflect it. The Frank National Bank building displayed the entire history of Roman art in well-chosen specimens. For a long time, it had been considered the best building of the city, because no other structure could boast a single classical item which it did not possess. It offered so many columns, pediments, friezes, tripods, gladiators, urns, and volutes, that it looked as if it had not been built of white marble, but squeezed out of a pastry tube. It was, however, built of white marble. No one knew that but the owners who had paid for it. It was now of a streaked, blotched, leprous color, neither brown nor green, but the worst tones of both, the color of slow rot, the color of smoke, gas fumes, and acids eating into a delicate stone intended for clean air and open country. The Frank National Bank building, however, was a great success. It had been so great a success that it was the last structure Guy Francone ever designed. Its prestige spared him the bother from then on. 3 blocks east of the Frank National Bank stood the Dana building. It was some stories lower and without any prestige whatever. Its lines were hard and simple, revealing, emphasizing, the harmony of the steel skeleton within, as a body reveals the perfection of its bones. It had no other ornament to offer. It displayed nothing but the precision of its sharp angles, the modeling of its planes, the long streaks of its windows like streams of ice running down from the roof to the pavements. New Yorkers seldom looked at the Dana building. Sometimes a rare country visitor would come upon it unexpectedly in the moonlight, and stop, and wonder from what dream that vision had come. But such visitors were rare. The tenants of the Dana building said that they would not exchange it for any structure on earth. They appreciated the light, the air, the beautiful logic of the plan in their halls and offices. But the tenants of the Dana building were not numerous. No prominent man wished his business to be located in a building that looked like a warehouse. The Dana building had been designed by Henry Cameron. In the 1880s, the architects of New York fought one another for second place in their profession. No one aspired to the first. The first was held by Henry Cameron. Henry Cameron was hard to get in those days. He had a waiting list 2 years in advance. He designed personally every structure that left his office. He chose what he wished to build. When he built, a client kept his mouth shut. He demanded of all people the one thing he had never granted anybody, obedience. He went through the years of his fame like a projectile flying to a goal no one could guess. People called him crazy, but they took what he gave them, whether they understood it or not, because it was a building by Henry Cameron. At first, his buildings were merely a little different, not enough to frighten anyone. He made startling experiments once in a while, but people expected it, and one did not argue with Henry Cameron. Something was growing in him with each new building, struggling, taking shape, rising dangerously to an explosion. the explosion came with the birth of the skyscraper. When structures began to rise, not in tier on ponderous tier of masonry, but as arrows of steel shooting upward without weight or limit, Henry Cameron was among the first to understand this new miracle and to give it form. He was among the first and the few who accepted the truth that a tall building must look tall. While architects cursed, wondering how to make a 20-story building look like an old brick mansion, while they used every horizontal device available in order to cheat it of its height, shrink it down to tradition, hide the shame of its steel, make it small, safe, and ancient. Henry Cameron designed skyscrapers in straight, vertical lines, flaunting their steel and height. While architects drew friezes and pediments, Henry Cameron decided that the skyscraper must not copy the Greeks. Henry Cameron decided that no building must copy any other. He was 39 years old then, short, stocky, unkempt. He worked like a dog, missed his sleep and meals, drank seldom, but then brutally, called his clients unprintable names, laughed at hatred, and fanned it deliberately, behaved like a feudal lord and a longshoreman, and lived in a passionate tension that stung men in any room he entered, a fire neither they nor he could endure much longer. It was the year 1892. The Columbian Exposition of Chicago opened in the year 1893. The Rome of 2,000 years ago rose on the shores of Lake Michigan, a Rome improved by pieces of France, Spain, Athens, and every style that followed it. It was a dream city of columns, triumphal arches, blue lagoons, crystal fountains, and popcorn. Its architects competed on who could steal best, from the oldest source and from the most sources at once. It spread before the eyes of a new country every structural crime ever committed in all the old ones. It was white as a plague, and it spread as such. People came, looked, were astounded, and carried away with them, to the cities of America, the seeds of what they had seen. The seeds sprouted into weeds, into shingled post offices with Doric porticos, brick mansions with iron pediments, lofts made of 12 Parthenons piled on top of one another. The weeds grew and choked everything else. Henry Cameron had refused to work for the Columbian Exposition, and had called it names that were unprintable but repeatable, though not in mixed company. They were repeated. It was repeated also that he had thrown an inkstand at the face of a distinguished banker who had asked him to design a railroad station in the shape of the Temple of Diana at Ephesus. The banker never came back. There were others who never came back. Just as he reached the goal of long, struggling years, just as he gave shape to the truth he had sought, the last barrier fell closed before him. A young country had watched him on his way, had wondered, had begun to accept the new grandeur of his work. A country flung 2,000 years back in an orgy of classicism could find no place for him and no use. It was not necessary to design buildings any longer, only to photograph them. The architect with the best library was the best architect. Imitators copied imitations. To sanction it, there was culture. There were 20 centuries unrolling and moldering ruins. There was the Great Exposition. There was every European postcard in every family album. Henry Cameron had nothing to offer against this, nothing but a faith he held merely because it was his own. He had nobody to quote, and nothing of importance to say. He said only that the form of a building must follow its function, that the structure of a building is the key to its beauty, that new methods of construction demand new forms, that he wished to build as he wished, and for that reason only. But people could not listen to him when they were discussing Vitruvius, Michelangelo, and Sir Christopher Wren. Men hate passion, any great passion. Henry Cameron made a mistake. He loved his work. That was why he fought. That was why he lost. People said he never knew that he had lost. If he did, he never let them see it. As his clients became rarer, his manner to them grew more overbearing. The less the prestige of his name, the more arrogant the sound of his voice pronouncing it. He had had an astute business manager, a mild, self-effacing little man of iron, who in the days of his glory faced quietly the storms of Cameron's temper and brought him clients. Cameron insulted the clients, but the little man made them accept it and come back. The little man died. Cameron had never known how to face people, They did not matter to him, as his own life did not matter, as nothing mattered but buildings. He had never learned to give explanations, only orders. He had never been liked. He had been feared. No one feared him any longer. He was allowed to live. He lived to loathe the streets of the city he had dreamed of rebuilding. He lived to sit at the desk in his empty office, motionless, idle, waiting. He lived to read in a well-meaning newspaper account a reference to the late Henry Cameron. He lived to begin drinking, quietly, steadily, terribly, for days and nights at a time, and to hear those who had driven him to it say, when his name was mentioned for a commission, "Cameron, I should say not. He drinks like a fish. That's why he never gets any work." He lived to move from the offices that occupied three floors of a famous building to one floor on a less expensive street, then to a suite farther downtown, then to three rooms facing an air shaft near the Battery. He chose these rooms because, by pressing his face to the window of his office, he could see, over a brick wall, the top of the Dana Building. Howard Rourke looked at the Dana Building beyond the windows, stopping at each landing, as he mounted the six flights of stairs to Henry Cameron's office. The elevator was out of order. The stairs had been painted a dirty file green a long time ago. A little of the paint remained to grate under shoe soles in crumbling patches. Rourke went up swiftly, as if he had an appointment, a folder of his drawings under his arm, his eyes on the Dana Building. He collided once with a man descending the stairs. This had happened to him often in the last 2 days. He had walked through the streets of the city, his head thrown back, noticing nothing but the buildings of New York. In the dark cubbyhole of Cameron's anteroom stood a desk with a telephone and a typewriter. A gray-haired skeleton of a man sat at the desk in his shirt sleeves, with a pair of limp suspenders over his shoulders. He was typing specifications intently, with two fingers and incredible speed. The light from a feeble bulb made a pool of yellow on his back where the damp shirt stuck to his shoulder blades. The man raised his head slowly when Rourke entered. He looked at Rourke, said nothing, and waited, his old eyes weary, unquestioning, incurious.
"I should like to see Mr. Cameron," said Rourke.
"Yeah," said the man, without challenge, offense, or meaning.
"About what?"
"About a job."
"What job?"
"Drafting."
The man sat looking at him blankly. It was a request that had not confronted him for a long time. He rose at last, without a word, shuffled to a door behind him, and went in. He left the door half open. Rourke heard him drawling,
"Mr. Cameron, there's a fellow outside says he's looking for a job here."
Then a voice answered, a strong, clear voice that held no tones of age.
"Why, the damn fool. Throw him out. Wait, send him in."
The old man returned, held the door open, and jerked his head at it silently. Rourke went in. The door closed behind him. Henry Cameron sat at his desk at the end of a long, bare room. He sat bent forward, his forearms on the desk, his two hands closed before him. His hair and his beard were coal black, with coarse threads of white. The muscles of his short, thick neck bulged like ropes. He wore a white shirt with the sleeves rolled above the elbows. The bare arms were hard, heavy, and brown. The flesh of his broad face was rigid, as if it had aged by compression. The eyes were dark, young, living. Rourke stood on the threshold, and they looked at each other across the long room. The light from the air shaft was gray, and the dust on the drafting table, on the few green files, looked like fuzzy crystals deposited by the light. But on the wall between the windows, Rourke saw a picture. It was the only picture in the room. It was the drawing of a skyscraper that had never been erected. Rourke's eyes moved first, and they moved to the drawing. He walked around the office, stopped before it, and stood looking at it. Cameron's eyes followed him, a heavy glance, like a long, thin needle held fast at one end, describing a slow circle, its point piercing Rourke's body, keeping it pinned firmly. Cameron looked at the orange hair, at the hand hanging by his side, its palm to the drawing, the fingers bent slightly, forgotten not in a gesture, but in the overture to a gesture of asking or seizing something.
"Well," said Cameron at last, Did you come to see me or did you come to look at pictures?
Rourke turned to him. Both, said Rourke. He walked to the desk. People had always lost their sense of existence in Rourke's presence, but Cameron felt suddenly that he had never been as real as in the awareness of the eyes now looking at him.
What do you want? Snapped Cameron.
I should like to work for you, said Rourke quietly. The voice said, I should like to work for you. The tone of the voice said, I'm going to work for you.
Are you? Said Cameron, not realizing that he answered the unpronounced sentence. What's the matter? None of the bigger and better fellows will have you?
I have not applied to anyone else.
Why not? Do you think this is the easiest place to begin? Think anybody can walk in here without trouble? Do you know who I am?
Yes, that's why I'm here.
Who sent you?
No one.
Why the hell should you pick me?
I think you know that.
What infernal impudence made you presume that I'd want you? Have you decided that I'm so hard up that I'd throw the gates open for any punk who'd do me the honor? Old Cameron, you've said to yourself. Is a has-been, a drunken... Come on, you've said it. A drunken failure who can't be particular. Is that it? Come on, answer me. Answer me, damn you. What are you staring at? Is that it? Go on, deny it.
It's not necessary.
Where have you worked before?
I'm just beginning.
What have you done?
I've had 3 years at Stanton.
Ho, ho! The gentleman was too lazy to finish.
I have been expelled.
Great.
Cameron slapped the desk with his fist and laughed.
Splendid. You're not good enough for the lice nest at Stanton, but you'll work for Henry Cameron. You've decided this is the place for refuse? What did they kick you out for? Drink? Women? What?
These, said Rourke, and extended his drawings. Cameron looked at the first one, then at the next, then at every one of them to the bottom. Rourke heard the paper rustling as Cameron slipped one sheet behind another. Then Cameron raised his head.
Sit down.
Rourke obeyed. Cameron stared at him, his thick fingers drumming against the pile of drawings.
So you think they're good? Said Cameron. Well, they're awful. It's unspeakable. It's a crime. Look,
he shoved a drawing at Rourke's face.
Look at that. What in Christ's name was your idea? What possessed you to indent that plan here? Did you just want to make it pretty because you had to patch something together? Who do you think you are? Guy Francone, God help you? Look at this building, you fool. You get an idea like this and you don't know what to do with it. You stumble on a magnificent thing and you have to ruin it. Do you know how much you've got to learn?
Yes, that's why I'm here.
And look at that one. I wish I'd done that at your age. But why did you have to botch it? Do you know what I'd do with that? Look, to hell with your stairways and to hell with your furnace room. When you lay the foundations...
He spoke furiously for a long time. He cursed. He did not find one sketch to satisfy him. But Rourke noticed that he spoke as of buildings that were in construction. He broke off abruptly, pushed the drawings aside, and put his fist over them. He asked,
When did you decide to become an architect?
When I was 10 years old.
Men don't know what they want so early in life, if ever. You're lying.
Am I?
Don't stare at me like that. Can't you look at something else? Why did you decide to be an architect?
I didn't know it then, but it's because I've never believed in God.
Come on, talk sense.
Because I love this earth. That's all I love. I don't like the shape of things on this earth. I want to change them.
For whom?
For myself.
How old are you?
22.
Where did you hear all that?
I didn't.
Men don't talk like that at 22. You're abnormal.
Probably.
I didn't mean it as a compliment.
I didn't either.
Got any family?
No.
Worked through school?
Yes.
At what?
In the building trades.
How much money have you got left?
$17.30.
When did you come to New York?
Yesterday. Cameron looked at the white pile under his fist.
God damn you,
said Cameron softly.
God damn you,
roared Cameron suddenly, leaning forward.
I didn't ask you to come here. I don't need any draftsmen. There's nothing here to draft. I don't have enough work to keep myself and my men out of the Bowery mission. I don't want any fool visionaries starving around here. I don't want the responsibility. I didn't ask for it. I never thought I'd see it again. I'm through with it. I was through with that many years ago. I'm perfectly happy with the drooling dolts I've got here who never had anything and never will have, and it makes no difference what becomes of them. That's all I want. Why did you have to come here? You're setting out to ruin yourself. You know that, don't you? And I'll help you to do it. I don't want to see you. I don't like you. I don't like your face. You look like an insufferable egotist. You're impertinent. You're too sure of yourself. 20 years ago, I'd have punched your face with the greatest of pleasure. You're coming to work here tomorrow at 9 o'clock sharp.
Yes, said Rourke, rising.
$15 a week. That's all I can pay you.
Yes.
You're a damn fool. You should have gone to someone else. I'll kill you if you go to anyone else. What's your name?
Howard Rourke.
If you're late, I'll fire you.
Yes.
Rourke extended his hand for the drawings.
Leave these here, bellowed Cameron. Now get out.
Chapter 4
Tui, said Guy Francone. Ellsworth Tui. Pretty decent of him, don't you think? Read it, Peter.
Francone leaned jovially across his desk and handed to Keating the August issue of New Frontiers. New Frontiers had a white cover with a black emblem that combined a palette, a lyre, a hammer, a screwdriver, and a rising sun. It had a circulation of 30,000 and a following that described itself as the intellectual vanguard of the country. No one had ever risen to challenge the description. Keating read from an article entitled Marble and Mortar by Ellsworth M. Tui. And now we come to another notable achievement of the metropolitan skyline. We call the attention of the discriminating to the new Melton building by Francone and Heyer. It stands in white serenity as an eloquent witness to the triumph of classical purity and common sense. The discipline of an immortal tradition has served here as a cohesive factor in evolving a structure whose beauty can reach, simply and lucidly, the heart of every man in the street. There is no freak exhibitionism here, no perverted striving for novelty, no orgy of unbridled egotism. Guy Francone, its designer, has known how to subordinate himself to the mandatory canons which generations of craftsmen behind him have proved inviolate, and at the same time how to display his own creative originality, not in spite of, but precisely because of, the classical dogma he has accepted with the humility of a true artist. It may be worth mentioning, in passing, that dogmatic discipline is the only thing which makes true originality possible. More important, however, is the symbolic significance of a building such as this rising in our imperial city. As one stands before its southern facade, one is stricken with the realization that the string courses, repeated with deliberate and gracious monotony from the third to the 18th story, these long, straight horizontal lines are the moderating, leveling principle, the lines of equality. They seem to bring the towering structure down to the humble level of the observer. They are the lines of the earth, of the people, of the great masses. They seem to tell us that none may rise too high above the restraint of the common human level, that all is held and shall be checked, even as this proud edifice, by the string courses of men's brotherhood.
There was more.
Keating read it all, then raised his head.
Gee, he said, awed.
Francone smiled happily.
Pretty good, eh? And from Tui, no less. Not many people might have heard the name, but they will, mark my word, they will. I know the signs. So he doesn't think I'm so bad, and he's got a tongue like an ice pick when he feels like using it. You see what he says about others more often than not. You know Durkin's latest mousetrap? Well, I was at a party where Tui said...
Francone chuckled.
He said, if Mr. Durkin suffers under the delusion that he is an architect, someone should mention to him the broad opportunities offered by the shortage of skilled plumbers. That's what he said. Imagine, in public.
I wonder, said Keating wistfully, what he'll say about me when the time comes.
What on earth does he mean by that symbolic significance stuff and the string courses of men's brotherhood? Oh, well, if that's what he praises us for, we should worry.
It's the critic's job to interpret the artist, Mr. Francone, even to the artist himself. Mr. Toohey has merely stated the hidden significance that was subconsciously in your own mind.
Oh, said Francone vaguely.
Oh, do you think so? He added brightly.
Quite possible. Yes, quite possible. You're a smart boy, Peter.
Thank you, Mr. Francone. Keating made a movement to rise.
Wait, don't go.
One more cigarette, and then we'll both return to the drudgery.
Francone was smiling over the article, reading it again. Keating had never seen him so pleased. No drawing in the office, no work accomplished, had ever made him as happy as these words from another man on a printed page to be read by other eyes. Keating sat easily in a comfortable chair. His month with the firm had been well spent. He had said nothing and done nothing, but the impression had spread through the office that Guy Francone liked to see this particular boy sent to him whenever anyone had to be sent. Hardly a day passed without the pleasant interlude of sitting across the desk from Guy Francone in a respectful, growing intimacy, listening to Francone's sighs about the necessity of being surrounded by men who understood him. Keating had learned all he could about Guy Francone from his fellow draftsmen. He had learned that Guy Francone ate moderately and exquisitely, and prided himself on the title of gourmet, that he had graduated with distinction from the École des Beaux-Arts, that he had married a great deal of money, and that the marriage had not been a happy one, that he matched meticulously his socks with his handkerchiefs, but never with his neckties, that he had a great preference for designing buildings of gray granite, that he owned a quarry of gray granite in Connecticut, which did a thriving business, that he maintained a magnificent bachelor apartment done in plum-colored Louis XV, that his wife, of a distinguished old name, had died, leaving her fortune to their only daughter, that the daughter, now 19, was away at college. These last facts interested Keating a great deal. He mentioned to Francone tentatively, in passing, the subject of his daughter.
"Oh, yes,"
Francone said thinly.
"Yes, indeed."
Keating abandoned all further research into the matter for the time being. Francone's face had declared that the thought of his daughter was painfully annoying to him, for some reason which Keating could not discover. Keating had met Lucius N. Heyer, Francone's partner, and had seen him come to the office twice in 3 weeks, but had been unable to learn what service Heyer rendered to the firm. Heyer did not have hemophilia, but looked as though he should have it. He was a withered aristocrat with a long, thin neck, pale, bulging eyes, and a manner of frightened sweetness toward everyone. He was the relic of an ancient family, and it was suspected that Francone had taken him into partnership for the sake of his social connections. People felt sorry for poor dear Lucius, admired him for the effort of undertaking a professional career, and thought it would be nice to let him build their homes. Francone built them, and required no further service from Lucius. This satisfied everybody. The men in the drafting rooms loved Peter Keating. He made them feel as if he had been there for a long time. He had always known how to become a part of any place he entered. He came soft and bright as a sponge to be filled unresisting with the air and the mood of the place. His warm smile, his gay voice, the easy shrug of his shoulders, seemed to say that nothing weighed too much within his soul, and so he was not one to blame, to demand, to accuse anything. As he sat now watching Francone read the article, Francone raised his head to glance at him. Francone saw two eyes looking at him with immense approval, and two bright little points of contempt in the corners of Keating's mouth, like two musical notes of laughter visible the second before they were to be heard. Francone felt a great wave of comfort. The comfort came from the contempt. The approval, together with that wise half-smile, granted him a grandeur he did not have to earn. A blind admiration would have been precarious. A deserved admiration would have been a responsibility. An undeserved admiration was precious.
When you go, Peter, give this to Miss Jeffers to put in my scrapbook.
On his way down the stairs, Keating flung the magazine high in the air and caught it smartly, his lips pursed, to whistle without sound. In the drafting room, he found Tim Davis, his best friend, slouched despondently over a drawing. Tim Davis was the tall blonde boy at the next table whom Keating had noticed long ago, because he had known, with no tangible evidence but with certainty, as Keating always knew such things, that this was the favored draftsman of the office. Keating managed to be assigned as frequently as possible to do parts of the projects on which Davis worked. Soon they were going out to lunch together, and to a quiet little speakeasy after the day's work, and Keating was listening with breathless attention to Davis talk about his love for one Elaine Duffy, not a word of which Keating ever remembered afterward. He found Davis now in black gloom, his mouth chewing furiously a cigarette and a pencil at once. Keating did not have to question him. He merely bent his friendly face over Davis's shoulder. Davis spit out the cigarette and exploded. He had just been told that he would have to work overtime tonight for the third time this week.
"Gotta stay late, God knows how late. Gotta finish this damn tripe tonight." He slammed the sheet spread before him. "Look at it, hours and hours and hours to finish it. What am I going to do?"
"Well, it's because you're the best man here, Tim, and they need you."
"To hell with that. I've got a date with Elaine tonight. How am I going to break it? Third time. She won't believe me. She told me so last time. That's the end. I'm going up to Guy the Mighty and tell him where he can put his plans and his job. I'm through."
"Wait," said Keating, and leaned closer to him. "Wait, there's another way. I'll finish them for you."
"Huh?
I'll stay. I'll do them. Don't be afraid. No one will tell the difference."
"Pete, would you?"
"Sure, I've nothing to do tonight. You just stay till they all go home, then skip."
"Oh, gee, Pete."
Davis sighed, tempted.
"But look, if they find out, they'll can me. You're too new for this kind of job."
"They won't find out."
"I can't lose my job, Pete. You know I can't. Elaine and I are going to be married soon. If anything happens..."
"Nothing will happen." Shortly after 6, Davis departed furtively from the empty drafting room, leaving Keating at his table. Bending under a solitary green lamp, Keating glanced at the desolate expanse of 3 long rooms, oddly silent after the day's rush, and he felt that he owned them, that he would own them, as surely as the pencil moved in his hand. It was 9:30 when he finished the plans, stacked them neatly on Davis's table, and left the office. He walked down the street, glowing with a comfortable, undignified feeling, as though after a good meal. Then the realization of his loneliness struck him suddenly. He had to share this with someone tonight. He had no one. For the first time, he wished his mother were in New York, but she had remained in Stanton, awaiting the day when he would be able to send for her. He had nowhere to go tonight, save to the respectable little boarding house on West 28th Street, where he could climb 3 flights of stairs to his clean, airless little room. He had met people in New York, many people, many girls, with one of whom he remembered spending a pleasant night, though he could not remember her last name. But he wished to see none of them. And then he thought of Catherine Halsey. He had sent her a wire on the night of his graduation, and forgotten her ever since. Now he wanted to see her. The desire was intense and immediate with the first sound of her name in his memory. He leaped into a bus for the long ride to Greenwich Village, climbed to the deserted top, and sitting alone on the front bench, cursed the traffic lights whenever they turned to red. It had always been like this where Catherine was concerned, and he wondered dimly what was the matter with him. He had met her a year ago in Boston, where she had lived with her widowed mother. He had found Catherine homely and dull on that first meeting, with nothing to her credit but her lovely smile, not a sufficient reason ever to see her again. He had telephoned her the next evening. Of the countless girls he had known in his student years, she was the only one with whom he had never progressed beyond a few kisses. He could have any girl he met, and he knew it. He knew that he could have Catherine. He wanted her. She loved him, and had admitted it simply, openly, without fear or shyness, asking nothing of him, expecting nothing. Somehow, he had never taken advantage of it. He had felt proud of the girls whom he escorted in those days, the most beautiful girls, the most popular, the best dressed, and he had delighted in the envy of his schoolmates. He had been ashamed of Catherine's thoughtless sloppiness, and of the fact that no other boy would look at her twice, but he had never been as happy as when he took her to fraternity dances. He had had many violent loves when he swore he could not live without this girl or that. He forgot Catherine for weeks at a time, and she never reminded him. He had always come back to her, suddenly, inexplicably, as he did tonight. Her mother, a gentle little schoolteacher, had died last winter. Catherine had gone to live with an uncle in New York. Keating had answered some of her letters immediately, others months later. She had always replied at once, and never written during his long silences, waiting patiently. He had felt when he thought of her that nothing would ever replace her. Then in New York, within reach of a bus or a telephone, he had forgotten her again for a month. He never thought, as he hurried to her now, that he should have announced his visit. He never wondered whether he would find her at home. He had always come back like this, and she had always been there. She was there again tonight. She opened the door for him on the top floor of a shabby, pretentious brownstone house. "Hello, Peter," she said, as if she had seen him yesterday. She stood before him, too small, too thin for her clothes. The short black skirt flared out from the slim band of her waist. The boyish shirt collar hung loosely, pulled to one side, revealing the knob of a thin collarbone. The sleeves were too long over the fragile hands. She looked at him, her head bent to one side. Her chestnut hair was gathered carelessly at the back of her neck, but it looked as though it were bobbed, standing light and fuzzy as a shapeless halo about her face. Her eyes were gray, wide, and nearsighted. Her mouth smiled slowly, delicately, enchantingly, her lips glistening. "Hello, Katie," he said. He felt at peace. He felt he had nothing to fear, in this house or anywhere outside. He had prepared himself to explain how busy he'd been in New York, but explanations seemed irrelevant now. "Give me your hat," she said. "Be careful of that chair, it's not very steady. We have better ones in the living room. Come in." The living room, he noticed, was modest, but somehow distinguished, and in surprisingly good taste. He noticed the books, cheap shelves rising to the ceiling, loaded with precious volumes, the volumes stacked carelessly, actually being used. He noticed over a neat, shabby desk, a Rembrandt etching, stained and yellow, found perhaps in some junk shop by the eyes of a connoisseur who had never parted with it, though its price would have obviously been of help to him. He wondered what business her uncle could be in. He had never asked. He stood looking vaguely at the room, feeling her presence behind him, enjoying that sense of certainty which he found so rarely. Then he turned and took her in his arms and kissed her. Her lips met his softly, eagerly. But she was neither frightened nor excited, too happy to accept this in any way save by taking it for granted. "God, I've missed you," he said, and knew that he had, every day since he'd seen her last, and most of all perhaps on the days when he had not thought of her. "You haven't changed much," she said. "You look a little thinner. It's becoming. You'll be very attractive when you're 50, Peter."
"That's not very complimentary." "By implication."
"Why? Oh, you mean I think you're not attractive now?
Oh, but you are." "You shouldn't say that right out to me like that."
"Why not? You know you are. But I've been thinking of what you'll look like at 50. You'll have gray temples, and you'll wear a gray suit. I saw one in a window last week, and I thought that would be the one. And you'll be a very great architect."
"You really think so?"
"Why, yes."
She was not flattering him. She did not seem to realize that it could be flattery. She was merely stating a fact, too certain to need emphasis. He waited for the inevitable questions, but instead they were talking suddenly of their old Stanton days together, and he was laughing, holding her across his knees, her thin shoulders leaning against the circle of his arm, her eyes soft, contented. He was speaking of their old bathing suits, of the runs in her stockings, of their favorite ice cream parlor in Stanton, where they had spent so many summer evenings together. And he was thinking dimly that it made no sense at all. He had more pertinent things to tell and to ask her. People did not talk like that when they hadn't seen each other for months. But it seemed quite normal to her. She did not appear to know that they had been parted. He was first to finally ask, "Did you get my wire?"
"Oh, yes, thanks."
"Don't you want to know how I'm getting along in the city?"
"Sure."
"How are you getting along in the city?" "Look here, you're not terribly interested."
"Oh, but I am.